for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. President Obama went to Manhattan and made a push for Wall Street reform. As the Senate prepares to debate financial regulation next week, the Securities and Exchange Commission brought a civil fraud suit against Goldman Sachs. And former Vice President Dick Cheney is the latest high-profile Republican to endorse Governor Charlie Crist's opponent in Florida's GOP Senate primary. Joining me for the domestic hour of our Friday news roundup, Naftali Ben-David at the Wall Street Journal, Cheryl Gay Stolberg at the New York Times, John Dickerson of Slate and CBS. Do join us, send us an email to drshow@wamu.org. Call us on 800-433-8850. Join us on Facebook. Send us a tweet. Good morning to all of you.
Good morning. Good morning, Diane.
And President Obama was in New York yesterday. What did he say, and how effective was his message, Naftali?
Well, it was a pretty strong message delivered, among other things, to Wall Street executives. It was in favor of the reform bill that's now moving through Congress, or that's about to be introduced in Congress. But it was pretty sharply worded. You know, he basically said that you have no reason to oppose this unless your business plan includes bilking people. So it was sort of a challenge in a way to say to them that you should be behind this, and to make it clear that part of his approach to all this is going to be drawing a line between himself and Wall Street, and that he believes that that is the politically correct place to be.
So what's the status of the legislation, Cheryl?
Well, the status of the legislation is Democrats want to move ahead with it, but yesterday Republicans in the Senate blocked a vote. So on Monday, Senator Harry Reid says he will call a procedural test vote called cloture to try to move ahead with this bill. There's been a lot of wrangling over this in the Senate. Republicans have accused Democrats of wanting to lay the groundwork for future bailouts. Democrats say Republicans are cozying up to the fat cats on Wall Street. We'll see how it goes. Many people, including myself, suspect that in the end there'll be some kind of bipartisan deal.
Help me with this charge of bailout. John, if you would, it seems to me that that term's been thrown around a great deal. Does it really apply in this case?
Well, no, not in the way in which it's been thrown around. In fact, freshman Tennessee Senator Bob Corker, who's worked on the bill, we've got two things going on. There's this fight between on the floor of the Senate, and then there's still negotiations going on between Democrats and Republicans about the shape of the bill. Democrats say it's delaying, Republicans saying they're just trying to shape the bill. Bob Corker is one of the people trying to get those details worked out. He said that this is not, that the key provision being debated is a $50 billion liquidation fund that basically helps kill banks faster. When banks are dying, you can't let them die immediately because creditor, that would be too much chaos. It would set off chaos in the market. The creditors would react. So what you need to do is, while you're killing a bank, you need to have some amount of money to unwind it in an orderly fashion, get everybody out to the exits in a way that is not creating of chaos. Republicans have said that fund amounts to a public bailout. There are other elements they say are bailouts, too. There's a percentage of provision having to do with the FDIC and how much loans it can take against the value of the bank it's unwinding and other complexities. But it's this $50 billion liquidation fund that Bob Corker said is not a bailout fund.
Well, beyond that, that fund is funded to a large degree by the financial industry itself. In other words, banks have to pay into it. And I think it's fair to say
Not
taxpayers' money. The commonly understood definition of a bailout is something where government and taxpayers' money is going to save a company. In this case, the companies wouldn't be saved and the money wouldn't be the taxpayers'.
But would the banks pass that money on to depositors, Cheryl?
Well, that's possible. But, you know, Diane, I think it's important to say that this whole bailout debate is really kind of a red herring. You know, the White House is not even wedded to this fund. It wasn't in the White House's original proposal. They've clearly sent out a message that they could live without it. It almost seems to me that Republicans are trying to opposed this bill, and they latched onto this as a way to fight it. But that strategy, frankly, seems to be unraveling in the facts of it.
They have a secondary argument, which is that the existence of such a fund, which, by the way, there are two ways it can be funded. One is the banks pay a tax beforehand, so there's a pot of money ready there for when a bank fails. And then there's another argument for doing it, for collecting the money after the failure happens. The government will pay for it, and then sort of the Wall Street banks will get the tab. Republicans argue that that this will encourage excessive risk-taking. If banks know there's a fund to help them unwind if they fail, that they'll take excessive risks. Others say that's a red herring.
What about the whole question of derivatives, Naftali?
Well, there was a very interesting development that happened this week where a Senate committee passed a bill that would become part of this larger bill to regulate derivatives, which are these obscure financial instruments that caused a lot of the problems in the financial meltdown. But one of the key things that happened was that a senior Republican, Charles Grassley, voted for this bill.
How come?
Well, you know, it's hard to say why. He didn't give a specific reason. He's a guy who's always been in favor of whistleblower-type provisions, and there are whistleblower-type provisions in this bill. But I think we have to look at the bigger picture, which is that this is not like the health care debate, where the Republicans really felt like the public was on their side, and they had no problem politically opposing this at every turn. In this case, I think the Democrats have successfully made this a battle of, are you for the people or are you for Wall Street? I think the Republicans want to be careful to be on the right side of that debate. And I think that's why we're seeing a lot of the movement that we're seeing.
I think that's exactly right. And I think that we have a midterm election coming up. Republicans have already taken a very firm stance against the health care bill. So they don't want to go into this election being perceived as the party of no. And they know that the public is very agitated about the behavior of Wall Street during this financial meltdown.
Agitated is a mild word.
Agitated is a mild word. Outraged, furious. And so I think Republicans recognize that they are going to need to find some way into this bill to support it, maybe make their stand against, say, this $50 billion fund. But at the end of the day, they're probably going to have to get on board. And I think the Grassley vote was maybe the first sign that we'll see a little bit more of that.
There was a poll out this week, a Gallup poll, that showed that if you talk about this as just a banking bill, the public doesn't support it nearly as much as if you talk about it as Wall Street reform, getting to your point, Diane, about the anger about Wall Street. There's a little interesting sideshow on the derivatives front, which is that Blanche Lincoln, the Democratic senator who chairs the committee, the Agriculture Committee, that reported out this bill creating new regulations for derivatives, is having some difficulty getting it into the underlying banking bill. There are various reasons for this, but it may come up sort of – there is a competing derivatives portion of the underlying banking bill, and there's now a fight among Democrats about how severe to be about derivatives. The important thing at the end is there are two different ways you can regulate derivatives. You can have an exchange, which is like the normal stock exchanges we know now, where the trading happens in public. But then there's something called a clearinghouse, which is, according to the experts, the more important part of this, which is that these derivatives are not traded among, say, the four of us individually. So where if one deal goes down, it can knock out a whole bunch of people who are not even involved in the deal. That all derivatives deals go through one central clearinghouse, which helps limit the exposure if there's a nightmare scenario like the ones we've just been through in the last few years.
John Dickerson, he's chief political correspondent, pardon me, for Slate.com, CBS political analyst and contributor. Do join us, 800-433-8850. What about the SEC charge of Goldman Sachs with fraud, Naftali?
Well, that was another interesting development that sort of dropped like a bombshell in the middle of this whole thing. And Democrats felt like it gave them momentum because it highlighted the potential wrongdoing of Goldman Sachs, which for many people has come to symbolize the Wall Street behemoth that was responsible for a lot of this. Rightly or wrongly, it's become a symbol, I think. Republicans wonder or ask if the whole thing wasn't politically motivated. They raise questions about the timing, and their allegation essentially is that the lawsuit was filed by the administration as a way to give momentum to the legislation. I don't know that there's a lot of evidence for that. And my own sense is that what the SEC is trying to do is to show that it's not a paper tiger. It came under a lot of criticism during the financial meltdown for not doing more to rein in some of these egregious practices. Now they're trying to show that they can indeed be effective. But Republicans do point to the fact that the two Republicans on the SEC voted against proceeding with this lawsuit, and that adds a little bit to the perception that maybe there was something political about
it. I see. Sure.
And, you know, President Obama addressed this in an interview earlier this week. He said, absolutely not. No heads up. Not, you know, no winks or nods. He said his administration didn't know about this SEC filing until they saw it on TV. Well, true. You know, he says so.
What do you think, John Dickerson?
Well, Congressman Issa, who is the ranking member on the House Oversight Committee, wants to look into this question of what they knew. The SEC has also said there was no connection. There's not supposed to be any connection. Secretary of the Treasury has said there's no connection. The question is, why now? This investigation of Goldman's been going on for a couple of years. Usually banks are given a chance to kind of try and settle. In this case, Goldman says they weren't given a chance at the last to settle. This came out in this very extraordinarily heated moment. It adds a lot of wind to the backs of those who want to regulate. One interesting little sideshow, Goldman has in fact become the poster child for this. Lloyd Blankfein, his CEO, was in the audience when President Obama spoke. President Obama called on the Wall Street banks to stop lobbying again. His reform package. He could have turned to Blankfein, whose firm includes a lot of people who gave to Obama, and said, hey, Lloyd, stop it. He didn't actually do that.
I want to get to the Wall Street Journal report that a Goldman director tipped off somebody about Warren Buffett's Berkshire Hathaway $5 billion investment before it went public. Naftali.
Yeah, that's something I guess we have to see. I mean, that's a report that we had, and I guess that's just we're going to have to wait for an investigation to see what's behind that.
Naftali Ben-David, he's national correspondent for The Wall Street Journal. Short break, and when we come back, we'll talk about the economy. Take your questions, your calls, and email. I look forward to hearing from you. And welcome back to the Domestic Hour of our Friday News Roundup. This week with Cheryl Gay Stolberg at the New York Times, Naftali Ben-David at the Wall Street Journal, John Dickerson at Slate.com, and CBS. Do join us with your phone calls, your email. You can join us on Facebook or send us a tweet. I want to ask you about taxes. Do you believe that the Obama administration is edging toward a value-added tax? John Dickerson.
Well, it's quite hard to tell. If you listen to Robert Gibbs and other spokesmen for the administration, they admit the president is not thinking about this. It's not on his radar screen. It's not being discussed. And if you ask the president, as he was asked by John Harwood on CNBC, the president said, well, I want to take a look at everything out there. Paul Volcker, who is one of the president's advisors on the economy, said in a speech that the VAT is not as toxic as it once was, that this might be the only way to take care of the larger deficit problem. It's coming up up in the context of the president's deficit commission and finding ways to deal with the deficit problem. And so Volcker floated the idea that the VAT would be the only way to raise revenue, sufficient revenue necessary to close the gap. Also, one other data point is Austin Goolsbee, one of the president's other economic advisors, was asked on about this question and didn't rule it out, which is one of the games we play. But it was not a basically they're saying we want to wait and see what the report is. So it's still on the table.
I don't know. I think the White House is going to run far away from the VAT. Since the beginning of the administration, the president has been battered by charges from Republicans that he is moving the United States to European-style socialism. The VAT is a tax that is popular in Europe. This is the last thing President Obama wants to do right now. The Senate had a vote this week, sort of a sense of the Senate resolution about the VAT, 85 to 13, saying that it would be detrimental to the American economy. So I think it's a political suicide mission to even adopt it. I can't figure out why he's even saying he's open to it.
I actually totally agree with that. I think it's one of, by the way, we should say that the VAT is a national sales tax, which is something that they do have in a lot of other countries.
But wouldn't it hit higher income people who are buying more expensive items?
Well, you could structure it in a lot of different ways.
Yeah.
And one of the things is that liberals are very suspicious of it because in many cases it can be the opposite. It can be regressive. In other words, if it's a broad one, it would affect lower income people more.
Right.
If it's targeted, you could probably do it in a way so that it would go after high income people, which is why it's not just conservatives who are opposed to this, but some liberals are very suspicious of it as well. I mean, my sense is what you have here is a little bit of a clash between scholars and academics on the one hand and politicians on the other, where experts and scholars look around and they say, look, the country has a huge debt problem. This is something that's done in a lot of places. Why wouldn't you at least look at it? And politicians say, well, you wouldn't look at it because it would be politically suicidal. That's why you wouldn't do it. And so my own sense is that it's not something that has a realistic chance, but it is something that smart people are saying at least we should look at.
And I think that's exactly right. It is politically suicide. I think to the extent the president is saying he's open, it may just simply be that before this commission gives its recommendations, he wants to say all options are on the table and look as though he's casting a broad and wide net, because in the context of assessing whatever the commission reports, he'll want Republicans and others to say, look, taxes in some form should be on the table. Things should be to have a realistic discussion about our deficit and debt. We need to think all things are on the table. And so maybe he's just keeping faith with that notion.
And also a bit of interpersonal relations here. Paul Volcker is the head of the president's economic and advisory board. So Volcker has thrown out this issue. Why would the president embarrass or be disrespectful to him by saying, no, I absolutely won't consider that?
Let me ask you all about something, a way that ordinary people get around paying taxes on high-value items, going to Amazon, for example, for a $2,000 television set, paying no taxes in the process. Doesn't that sort of undermine the whole process of what we ought to be paying taxes on?
Well, it does, and it's an argument not to do the VAT because it would simply drive more purchasing to the internet.
Unless you began to
tax purchases on the internet, and every state has a different sales tax. I frankly don't know how you would do that. It seems like it'd be a regulatory nightmare.
Well, and to the extent anybody's ever had a conversation about taxing anything on the internet, it dies quickly for all the political reasons we're talking about. And so this is just one tiny way in which we can see the political difficulty of trying to get a VAT out the door.
Okay, let's talk about GM's and Chrysler's better than expected progress on paying back the government. What does that mean? Is the car business going to get back on its feet sooner than expected?
I mean, I think the answer is yes. I think clearly things are stabilizing a little bit, and they're stabilizing faster than people thought. Now, it has to be said, we're far from out of the woods. You know, the government still owns about 60% of GM, and it's not going to know how much of that it's going to recoup until the company goes public, which could happen later this year or even next year. And the government will probably lose money on the bailout. But I think clearly things have gotten better faster than people thought. And President Obama is probably entitled to and has been crowing a little bit about this, saying, this risky, politically unpopular thing I did is paying off. Having said that, people just hate bailouts. I mean, they hate the bank bailout, which also, by the way, is going better than expected. They hate the car bailout. They hate the whole idea. And so they're unlikely to be persuaded by the fact that maybe it's going a little bit better than they had initially thought.
But the White House was very happy about this. Robert Gibbs tweeted out to his followers, "Big news. GM pays back $6.7 billion," and then another tweet, "Bigger news, payments 5 years ahead of schedule." So they were clearly eager to trumpet this development.
Let me ask you all about Robert Gibbs. This was not something on our list today, but I've certainly been hearing, seeing comments to the effect that reporters are somehow dissatisfied with the way Robert Gibbs is handling his job.
Well, I guess this is my department since I cover the White House. He's an unusual press secretary in that he is more of a strategist and a close confidant to the president. So traditionally, press secretaries have straddled those two roles and have been very responsive to reporters. When you call Robert Gibbs, you often don't get a call back. Or if you email him, you often don't get an email back. He delegates that, and he tends to spend more of his time, I think, and is perhaps more personally satisfied by advising the president on the inside than dealing with reporters on the outside. Frankly, Diane, I don't think the public much cares if reporters are dissatisfied with the press secretary or not. And the other thing is that in this administration, unusually so, the top officials speak to reporters. So Rahm Emanuel is a very public presence. David Axelrod is a very public presence. Other top advisors talk directly to reporters, making the traditional press secretary's role a little bit less necessary.
I wonder whether there are rumors, however, that he is going to be replaced.
There are definitely rumors. I don't know. It replaced suggests perhaps an outside force causing him to move on. I think one of the problems in the administration is the president is the best spokesman. That's always the case, but he talks about everything. And I think they want to spread out the number of people who can talk, and that's part of what's at play here. Also, I think Gibbs doesn't want to do the day-to-day.
Yeah, I don't think replaced in terms of the administration being dissatisfied with him in any respect. He's very close to the president, and he knows President Obama's thinking. So my sense would be it would, frankly, be moved up and inside to a more internal role.
It's just very hard to do those two things that Cheryl mentioned, which is be the inside guy who's always in the room. If you're always in the room, you're not on the email responding.
All right. There were sobering poll results for government officials this week. Naftali Andrew Kohut, who took that poll for Pew, cited the dismal economy, an unhappy public, bitter partisan-based backlash, and epic discontent with Congress and elected officials. Is this a surprise?
Well, I actually don't think it's a surprise. I think it confirms what a lot of people have been feeling, which is that there's a great deal of distrust and even hostility toward the government, more than we've had in a long time. There were numbers like only 22% said they could trust the government all or most of the time. 30% see the government as a major threat to their personal liberty. I think what we're seeing here is a combination of this anti-government sentiment that's always there, but that flares up at certain times, and a great deal of economic anxiety.
But here's the interesting part, the contradictions. Americans apparently strongly believe more government control over the economy is a bad idea, but by a much bigger margin, they believe stricter regulation of financial companies is a good idea, John Dickerson.
Sure. Well, there are these tensions always exist. There was in polling about the Tea Party supporters that the New York Times and the CBS News did, there was agreement within this group that the size of government was terrible, but they loved Social Security and Medicare, two things responsible for the size of government. One thing that I thought was interesting in the poll that kind of gets at your point, which is that people are quite dissatisfied with the politicians. They believe in some sense that the system is not necessarily corrupt, but it's the people in it that are corrupt. And so you could see a situation in which you could believe that the system regulates Wall Street or banks or in a good way, but it's just the people who then get there that are the ones messing it up.
Yeah, there was a lot of more nuance in that poll, I think, than we're often than we're often told about. I mean, for one thing, people are really angry at all kinds of big institutions. They don't like business a whole lot better than they like government.
They don't like media very much either.
They don't like media. They never like the media. You know, there's also more of an expression of frustration at the inefficiency of government rather than really anger at its priorities. Mm. And one that I thought was really interesting was 56% of the people said they wanted their kids to pursue a career in government. So here there's supposedly this great hostility to this thing, but that's kind of what they want their kids to do.
So how is all this likely to affect midterm elections?
Well, I think, interestingly, there are partisan divides, or maybe not surprisingly, 43% felt the government was a major threat to their personal freedom among Republicans, 43%, but among Democrats, only 18%. I think this anger is energizing Republicans. We're already seeing it in the Tea Party movement, and there's a sense that Democrats, we already know, are going to suffer. Historically, Democrats suffer in an off-year election, so I think we'll see this anger play out in the polls, and probably to the Republicans' favor.
That's right. And the best thing Democrats can hope for, and it's not much, is that public opinion about Democrats has cratered from 62% at one point said they had a favorable impression of the Democratic Party. That's now down to just 40. But Republican public opinion about Republicans has not improved. But they do have the intensity which matters in off-year elections.
So this brings in Charlie Crist in Florida. Tell us about what Charlie Crist is thinking.
Well, at the moment, it appears that Charlie Crist is thinking about leaving the Republican Party. There were two options at the end of last week. He's getting pasted by Marco Rubio in the Republican primary race. Crist used to be up by 30 points in the polls. He now is down by 20 to Rubio. He cannot out-conservative him, which is to say he cannot appeal to Republican-based voters by saying, I am the true conservative in this race. So he had a decision. He could either become an independent, or he could just drop out altogether and run again in 2012. What we've seen in the last few days in some remarks he made, he responded to Dick Cheney endorsing Marco Rubio by saying this is just another Washington politician coming down. We see some, and he also voted against an education bill that a lot of Republicans were in favor of. He's burning some bridges in the Republican ranks, which suggests he's not dropping out to run in 2012 as a Republican, but going to run as an independent. And viewing this, lots of Republicans, Dick Cheney, Mitt Romney, former governor of Massachusetts, have come out and endorsed Rubio because there's a kind of first mover's advantage here, because once Crist becomes an independent, every Republican who hasn't already endorsed Rubio will be there in a second.
Yeah, I actually think endorsing Marco Rubio at this point doesn't take a lot of wisdom or courage. It's pretty clear that Crist is going to drop out of the race. He may or may not run as an independent, but he's probably not going to run as a Republican. And I actually think this is something that's happening to Republicans all around the country. And if there's any glimmer of hope for Democrats, it's the way that a lot of Republicans are divided among themselves. In almost every single Senate race, there's a mainstream establishment-type Republican who's being challenged by a conservative sort of firebrand insurgent. And in some cases, those insurgents are doing pretty well. And in every case, they're dividing the party to some degree. Mm. And I think we have to see how that plays out everywhere. It's been most dramatic in Florida, but that's far from the only place that it's happening.
Naftali Ben-David, The Wall Street Journal. You're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. We'll open the phones, 800-433-8850. First, let's go to Liverpool, New York, and to Lucy. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Diane. Good morning, panel.
Hi there.
My comment concerns the recent developments on Wall Street and the banks. I heard there's no agency that is going to be the watchdog over Wall Street and these banks to make sure that they do comply with the law. And I believe it was set up that way. One red flag for me was that the stock market went up after President Obama's speech because there is no enforcement. When we had real regulations by President Roosevelt, for example, after World War II, we had the greatest expansion of our economy. It took President Reagan and company, along with some Democrats in the 1980s, that removed these regulations. In my opinion, without regulations with real teeth to them, we cannot avoid another crash.
And that's the question. Will this bill have real teeth to it?
And that's something that I don't think has been resolved yet. You know, we don't actually have a bill yet. I mean, we're getting close, but there's still a lot of moving parts. I don't think it's fair to say there's no regulations. I think there was some move toward a single, strong regulating agency. And that was something that a lot of people didn't think was such a great idea. They thought the power should be a little bit dispersed. There are a couple of things that are going to be in this bill. There's going to be a consumer protection expansion agency designed solely to look out for consumers.
Under the Fed.
Well, that was one of the big debates, is exactly where it would be and how independent it would be. There's also something, an agency or a group of regulators, really, that are supposed to look at what's called systemic risk, which is to say they're supposed to keep an eye out for the kinds of huge problems within the system that led to the financial meltdown. There was nobody who really had that job before. So those two things will exist. But, you know, there is a debate about how strong the regulations should be. And in that sense, the caller's right.
And Lucy, tune in on Monday. We're going to do an hour on that very issue. Thanks for calling. To St. Louis, Missouri. Uno, you're on the air.
Good morning.
Morning.
I understand that there is nothing in this current financial reform legislation that addresses Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac. And it's my understanding also, weren't they the prime actors in precipitating this financial collapse? And wasn't there an attempt in 2005 to rein in Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac?
Thanks for calling. John Dickerson.
Well, the caller's right. There's not anything in it. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac played a big role in the financial collapse, but in this case, there were banks that took advantage of the mortgages, and that's what this bill goes after. But it does not answer that question at all, as far as I'm concerned.
And Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac are sort of unusual entities. They're sort of quasi-government entities, and I think the feeling is that any kind of attempt to rein them in or regulate them perhaps ought to be divorced from this banking bill, simply because it's apples and oranges.
Cheryl Gaze-Stolberg of The New York Times. Short break, and when we come back, more of your questions. I look forward to hearing from you.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the German Embassy and the German Information Center, whose Germany.info publishes news about politics, culture, and lifestyle at Germany.info. By the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, working to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. And by the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. This is NPR.
The Friday News Roundup. A panel of top journalists joins me to offer expert analysis of the week's top international stories. You've heard the headlines. Now find out what they mean for you. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. And we've had numerous emails on the question of whether a VAT would hit the internet. Will in Cavendish, Vermont says a VAT would hit the items sold on the internet since the VAT is imposed on every stage of the manufacturing and sales process. It works fine in Europe. It could level the playing field on internet bricks and mortar competition. What do you think, Cheryl?
I think the caller is right to an extent. In other words, a VAT is imposed along the chain of production. So if I make a product, or if I make a piece, a component of a product, and I sell it to you, you have to pay the VAT. And then you can deduct that from your taxes as a business expense, because you're then selling it to somebody else who's going to continue adding to it. And then once the final product gets sold, the finished goods, the end user pays the VAT. The question is, if that final product is sold on the internet, does the end user pay the tax on the internet? But it is, the VAT is imposed, the caller is quite right, is imposed all the way along the production chain on each step.
Naftali, do you want to add to that?
Well, I mean, I think that's basically true. I think that a lot of things would have to be worked out. I mean, I think there is a lot of ways that you could structure it. And it's true. That's one of the big questions that would have to be answered. But that's right. It's imposed at every stage along the process, and that makes it more complicated than an ordinary sales tax.
Okay. Becky joined us on Facebook. She says, I still trust the president, but I really, really don't trust much of the Congress or the Senate. I wish they would do their jobs rather than stumping for the next election. John Dickerson.
Well, fair enough. That sentiment's out there a lot. The thing of it is in fact Congress doing its job in public over the last year that accounts for a lot of the anger about the way Congress does its job. I mean, Congress, the making of legislation is incredibly messy. You know, in this case, in the healthcare debate, it was a fight among Democrats as much as it was a fight between Democrats and Republicans. This all took place out in public, and it was confusing, petty, disassociated from the way people live their lives, much of which is the way the system works. People got a full viewing of that and thought this doesn't look very appetizing at all. But they were, in fact, doing their jobs. And they've done their jobs on lots of other things as well.
Yeah, I mean, I this has actually been an extraordinarily productive session of Congress. I mean, I know it's sort of not cool to say that necessarily, but they've passed an enormous health overhaul. They passed a stimulus. They're probably going to have a rewrite of the entire fiscal financial sector. They've passed a lot of smaller things.
Not to mention an education bill.
Right.
An education bill, a lands bill, FDA regulation of tobacco, the S-CHIP program, credit card reforms. I mean, the fact is that people don't necessarily absorb this, but they've actually done a tremendous amount.
All right. To St. Louis, Missouri. Good morning, Terry. You're on the air.
Good morning. I just wanted to comment, I believe it was John Dickerson who said earlier in the program that the Tea Partiers are concerned about the size of government, but they love Social Security, said, as it always is, with a little bit of a chuckle, and that Social Security is responsible for the size of government. Well, I would like to point out a couple of things. Number one, seniors have paid into the program for 40 years. If you bought an annuity from an insurance company and now find that the insurance company is oppressive or making too much money or whatever your objection is, should you forego the annuity payments? And second, I think a completely restructured retirement program for young people would be an excellent idea. And I am a senior citizen and I am a Tea Partier. If we had the money that we had paid into Social Security and had been able to invest it, all analysis shows that we would have far more money now for our retirement than Social Security provides.
John Dickerson.
Well, these are two separate questions. The question of whether to have a different scheme for Social Security is worth debating. The point that I thought was interesting in that contradiction is that if you don't like the size of government, but you like the two things that are responsible both for its large size or a large portion of its size and that's responsible for the growth in government, that is a contradiction there. You don't want those two things to be cut. And if you don't cut those two things and you're not going to cut defense and you can't touch the interest we pay on the debt, you're left without very much to cut. And you either there's nothing to cut or you have to raise taxes so that, it just gives you a sense of there aren't a lot of choices.
Terry,
well, would you comment on my point that we have paid into this system for 40 years?
Well, you've paid into the system, and that's great, but it's
promise that we would get these benefits.
Right, but you make that case, and that's fine. And people who are on Medicare say we, have an expectation of Medicare coverage, and people, on down the line say they have this expectation, and if you take all the expectations and add them up, you have more government than you have revenues coming in to support that government. And so at some point, people have to have a conversation about how that math doesn't work.
Naftali.
Well, I agree with that, and I do think that there is some, there are things that can be done to Social Security, but I don't think that some of the things that are being proposed are the right answer.
How would you feel, Terry, about raising the retirement age by 2 years?
Well, I think it probably wouldn't be a bad idea. I mean, obviously, when Social Security was instituted, the life expectancy was 63 years, and few people were expected to even collect. Now the life expectancy is far higher, and it would be a reasonable change.
You've identified yourself as a member of the Tea Party. What is it that you, or how would you identify the things about which you are most unhappy with the federal government?
I think the federal government over the years, over the last 70 years particularly, has really overreached and extended its role far beyond what the Constitution originally.
How so? How so?
Well, for a Social Security, for one thing, the vast expansion of the use of the Commerce Clause in controlling every aspect of business. I am not a person who thinks there should be no regulation. I do believe that there are things that need to be regulated. However, I think that it is not the role of the government to tell us how much fat we can have in our diet and how many of our other personal decisions should be made.
Interesting. Naftali, do you want to comment?
Well, I only want to make a comment that's a little bit indirect, and that is that, you know, and that has to do with the death of the deficit hawk. In other words, there used to be this idea, particularly, I guess, in the Republican Party, that the most important thing was not to have a debt. But now it's not only can you not have a debt, but you can't have taxes either. The taxes have to be cut. And so that leaves you with very little sort of option except perhaps cutting spending, which is something that's very difficult to do. And I think that's kind of that relates to a lot of the things we've talked about. But if you're sort of one, if you're upset about the debt, but you also don't want to, you know, work on that debt by raising taxes, then you're left with very few options. And that's why you end up with people talking about things like Social Security, which they love, but they hate, Medicare, which they love and just love. But it just leaves you with very few options.
I think Terry did have an intellectually consistent position, which was, paid in money into Social Security, but wasn't using that to knock down all ideas about reforming it. In addition to raising the retirement age, which would get you some savings, you also can index the growth in Social Security to prices or to inflation and remove it from being indexed to wages, which grow a lot faster. Usually what happens is people say, I paid into Social Security, don't touch it, do nothing, and that's just not a position that can be held.
Yeah, I think we only have to look back a few years to see the difficulty that John is speaking of in attacking this problem. When President Bush was in office and Republicans were controlling Congress, and he tried very hard to do something about Social Security and to bring his own party along, and it was a disaster for him.
Three different options presented during the Bush administration. Nothing.
And Republicans
changed.
Were, you know, just going out there and getting hammered by their own constituents, don't mess with my Social Security.
And also, there's some indication that if people had taken their retirement funds and put them in the stock market instead, they'd be doing worse, not better. I mean, it's not exactly like the stock market has done that great. So I think it's not so simple that if people had just been able to invest their own funds, they'd be a lot better off than they are in Social Security.
All right, let's go now. Thanks for calling, Terry. Let's go to Berry in Springs, Michigan. Good morning, Arthur.
Hi, Diane.
Hi there.
I have a question, and my question is, how does this sort of a bailout and package and too big to fail relate to trickle-down economics? And allow me to briefly just frame my question. In about the 80s, when I believe Reagan instituted trickle-down economics, my understanding is that about 70 or 80% of the wealth of the United States, of the country, was in the hands of about 70% of the people. And now fast forward to today, with trickle-down economics, about 80% or 90% of the wealth of the country is actually in the hands of about 10 or 15% of the people, which, from what I see, amounted to a government-sponsored transfer of wealth in the 80s. And so this too big to fail now is a seems to me like a direct relationship with trickle-down economics, because trickle-down economics made the country, the people, completely, I shouldn't say completely, but mostly dependent on big business, so that now we our fate is so well tied together that if they fail, the country fails.
Well, that's a very interesting point. And there is part of this legislation that's being debated right now, which has to do with limiting the size of banks. This can be done in a number of different ways. You could keep the size of the deposits that people have to a certain size, or you could, for example, limit the non-deposit liabilities that banks have to a certain percentage of the GDP. That's something that's very much being talked about and very well could be in this legislation.
What about his point that the wealth of the nation is now in the hands of fewer and fewer people, John Dickerson?
Well, that's true. I'm trying to think through how that is associated with too big to fail. I guess one argument could be that the people who run the institutions that are deemed to be too big to fail tend to be the ones in that concentrated wealth cohort, and that those people tend to have lots and lots of power in Washington. I think the counterside of that argument is that too big to fail is not solely about the power of the people at the tops of those companies, but the fact that those companies and their interconnectedness with the economy creates a situation in which if there is a disorderly dissolution of those companies, that it has a ripple effect that, in fact, ends up hurting not necessarily the people who run those companies, but the rest of the economy. And so in that case, it's a trickling down of pain from the wealthy institutions to regular folks, and we've seen that over the last couple of years.
Yeah, I also think if it's not associated in sort of a direct economic way, it's associated in an emotional way. I think the caller is expressing a feeling that many people in the United States have, which is that the little guy has been left out, that big institutions, big Wall Street institutions control all the money, have all the power, get rich on the backs of the little guy. That's why this Goldman Sachs SEC investigation has had so much resonance, because people see that the allegation that Goldman sold securities to investors and then bet against them and made big bucks while the investors lost money. So I think he's expressing an emotional connection that many people feel.
Cheryl K. Stolberg of the New York Times, and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Here's an email from Bobby in Rochester, New York, who says, we've been hearing that regulations that control the use of derivatives will be bad for the economy. Can someone please explain why derivatives are good for the economy? It would seem these vehicles, often described as bets, merely move money from one person's pocket into the pockets of others, and nothing of real value is produced. Naftali.
Well, that's certainly the way a lot of people feel about it. And it's not just limited to derivatives. There are a series of financial instruments that have to do with essentially making bets, or you could say predictions, if you want to make it sound a little more reasonable, on how certain parts of the economy are going to perform. And they don't necessarily create wealth. One of the big criticisms of the procedure that Goldman Sachs is now in trouble for is that it precisely didn't involve investing in anything productive. It involved what a lot of people are calling a side bet on how subprime mortgages would perform. So no matter what happened, it wasn't going to make the economy somehow perform better. Just somebody was going to get rich and somebody else wasn't.
And now they're talking about derivatives on movie performances, John Dickerson?
Well, you can have a derivative basically on anything. And to the extent there is a good kind of derivative, it's the ones that, you know, existed in the 19th century for crop prices, where you made bets about and hedges against crop prices. And these were seen as helpful in commerce. There was, of course, at that point, a huge question about speculation, very similar to what we're discussing today. But outside of the agricultural context, you had these side bets, and you can make a side bet on anything. And as long as you partner with somebody else who's willing to take your bet in a way that's not regulated and nobody's watching, That can go on. The problem is if then you have to pay off that side bet, and that then affects everybody else. That's the problem we had over the last couple of years.
Nobody has told me why derivatives are good.
Why derivatives are good? Well, yeah. It's essentially it's insurance. So it allows you to take risks as a business person and have a little safety net if your risk doesn't go right. And so you pay a little insurance or you get somebody else to help you pay the insurance.
So George Soros bet against the U.S. dollar.
That is harder to defend because that is he's making a currency bet, and that is, you know, him playing, him watching the market and playing it. The better, the more easily defendable derivatives are the ones that help, you know, that are associated more with agriculture, that help people, that help create a market and help goods flow, and that's what they're trying not to kill.
I think the caller is actually hitting on something important, which is what is the social value of this kind of transaction?
Exactly.
And I think that that question is, frankly, very difficult to answer. They may be good, perhaps they, you know, some people certainly benefit from them, but is there a social value to it?
And social value is a really important question that at some point regulators are going to have to define. Cheryl Gaze Stolberg is White House correspondent for the New York Times. John Dickerson is with Slate.com and CBS. Naftali Ben-David is national correspondent for the Wall Street Journal. Thank you all so much. Have a great weekend, everybody. Thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR.